Well, good evening. It's a pleasure this evening to have my good friend Julie Mason. Julie and I sit next to one another in the basement of the White House press room. At one point, Julie was sitting on the right of where I sit. Now she sits on the left. So change news organizations, but not a lot changed.
Still down in the basement.
Yeah. But a great place to be and to observe White House operations.
I like to think it's like the movie Platoon. You know how the goody two shoes were upstairs in the bunker, and then like the cool guys were down below ground. That's what the White House basement is like.
Well, yesterday there was a reporter who hasn't been around for a while who came back, a television reporter, and was saying that she tells people what wonderful camaraderie there is. And I think that camaraderie particularly exists in the basement.
Definitely.
Yeah. And they were doing some filming yesterday morning, and the reporter who did his piece several times, he would come down the steps and he said, "Now we're entering a dark and dingy area." So I finally said to him, "It is not dingy."
Nor is it dark, but it was flooding, as I recall. It was damp.
Yeah, so that's true. Fortunately, he wasn't there when the flood came. Well, Julie is a reporter for the DC Examiner, Washington Examiner, and she has been a reporter for the Houston Chronicle as well. From Houston. She worked in Houston and then has worked in Washington at the Chronicle and then moved to the Examiner. Can you tell us about how you got to the White House and where did you start? And journalism, what was appealing to you then and how do you find it now?
I always wanted to be a journalist ever since I was very young. My mom had wanted to be a journalist, and she was not allowed because in her generation in Natick, Massachusetts, young women didn't become journalists. They became teachers, nurses, or, you know, some other thing that was appropriate for women. So from a very young age, she'd always push me towards journalism, and so it was always a goal that I had growing up. I never wanted to be anything else. And I started out as a clerk in the Washington Bureau of the Dallas Morning News. This was when I was still in college, and, you know, clipping papers, making coffee, getting lunch for the other reporters, which is something that they would never ask a clerk to do now, but I guess in the 80s it was sort of anything goes. And, I always had my eye, not on the White House, but I always thought it looked kind of cool, and my bureau chief at the time covered the White House, and he made it look kind of fun, and he made it seem fun and not something that was so very serious that it was unattainable. Of course, I knew I'd have to pay my dues, and that's what I did. That's how I got to the White House. I worked my way up in journalism through covering local political beats, and then state politics, and then national politics. I covered a couple presidential campaigns. And then after I covered John Kerry's 2004 campaign, by then I was here in Washington, then I got assigned to the White House. So I've been covering the White House since right after the 2004 campaign. At first, I covered it for the Houston Chronicle, which is a paper I worked at for 20 years. And then I got laid off in October, which is what happens these days in journalism. And I got picked up right away by the Washington Examiner, which has been an interesting experience. But they're great, and they're serious about covering the White House, and they recently sent me overseas with the president, so I have no complaints. I have a job.
Yes, the basement where we sit has just been decimated.
Decimated. Baltimore Sun gone. Yeah, Chicago Tribune, you know, seriously scaled back.
Yeah.
Houston Chronicle, well, their White House reporter got laid off.
Media General.
Media General dissolved. Cox Newspaper Bureau dissolved.
Yeah.
And there hasn't been much that has taken their place. We have a few more bloggers at the White House, but that's not the same as having a newspaper bureau and with a reporter assigned. So it's been sobering. It really has.
What do you think the impact is going to be at the state level with not having Washington
operation. Oh, it's
operation.
Terrible. You look at Copley News Service, which broke the Randy Duke Cunningham stories. Their bureau shut down. So it's that tough coverage of local delegations. You think of the Texas delegation to Congress. I mean, you know, they're all about half crazy, and they deserve constant full-time monitoring. And there's just a couple reporters still doing that. So it's very, very sad. There's going to be a great loss of public watchdogging. I mean, you know, the world probably has enough White House reporters, but in terms of state of local coverage in Washington, it's just disastrous.
Yeah. And it really has changed greatly. One of the things that that you do that I should have mentioned right at the start, in addition to your work with the Examiner, with print, is that you're very comfortable with new media. You do television. You do a lot of MSNBC.
Yeah. God bless MSNBC.
And then you also did blogging for the Houston Chronicle, and you're now doing the Examiner as well.
That's the thing, as a newspaper reporter, you can't just do your story for the paper anymore. You have to file one version to the web, and you got to blog some stuff, and then you got to go on TV and do radio, and then you have to write your story for the paper. It's your last priority of the day. So we're all multitasking now, and it's a survival thing. Although it doesn't save anyone's job, it does. I don't know. It just feels like what you have to do now.
Uh-huh. Do you find that that your reporting is better because of all the different types of things that you do?
Definitely. It when you're working on one story a day or a couple stories a day, you can really get tunnel vision. But doing all these other things keeps your mind snapping in different directions. And there have been plenty of times where I've done a hit on TV about something, and then I thought, and TV picks the topic. They'll say, can you come on and talk about the torture memos? And something in the questioning will make me think of a story that I'll then do for the paper. So, and it all ties in together, and then that could lead to a blog post, and et cetera, et cetera. So it all becomes one, but it becomes more massive, more complicated. But I just think it keeps your mind much more nimble.
Yeah. Well, yesterday you started with radio. I remember you said when did you go on radio?
There's this great radio show I love in New York called The Takeaway that's on public radio in New York, but the show is on at 6 a.m. So I have to get up at 5 and go down to the Christian Monitor. Christian Science Monitor has a great radio studio that they use for various things, and I did the show from there. It's on at 6 in the morning. And then I went home and slept for like a couple more hours, and then I got up and went back into the White House.
Yeah. What kind of stories have you been working on in the last few days?
Well, I did a story for today's paper about how many czars Obama has in his administration. These are people who don't require Senate confirmation. They don't have to be confirmed by anyone. They have an enormous amount of power. Usually they have the president's ear, but they don't have the accountability of, say, a political appointee, someone who does have to go through that process. And I did just a piece about how many he has, more than a dozen, by some estimation 18 or 19, but I think he has about 16-ish. And just how there's a concern about all this unchecked power and what their influence is and just things like that. And that was kind of a fun story. We try to go a little bit, not off the news. I cover Spot. You know, I covered Obama's first cabinet meeting yesterday. But then the czar story kind of grew out of that. It was like the cabinet members, like, yeah, whatever, but he's got all these czars. So we kind of try to do a little different take on the news.
Yeah, because his first cabinet meeting is very late.
Right.
Bush's first cabinet meeting was within the first week of his presidency.
Mm-hmm.
And most presidents do that. They have at least a symbolic cabinet meeting. And you could say on the one hand maybe he was waiting until everybody was confirmed, but everybody isn't confirmed.
That's right.
Sebelius.
That's right,
Right, hasn't been, and then Vilsack was on the road.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of hard getting everybody together.
It's been such a fractured process. I don't even feel like I have a good handle on this cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even think I could name them all at this point. I mean, I could if I really put my mind to it, but it's just been such a process and one step forward and two steps back for him, and the cabinet really hasn't emerged.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all policy is still from the White House out.
Uh-huh.
It's not from the agencies in.
Yeah, and I think that's probably what we're going to see.
Yeah, I think that's the policy.
and I think the gathering date was probably a good indicator of that, of
where it ranks on the priority list.
Yeah. Yesterday when let's not take yesterday because you had to get up to when you got up to do WNYC in New York. What did you read beforehand, and how do you prepare for something like that? But 6 o'clock in the morning,
right?
Do you do it the night before?
Yeah. I often do prep for that kind of thing the night before. I knew their Monday morning show is about the week ahead and what's coming up, and so I just kind of noodled around and read the latest White House briefing and figured out what they were up to and what Congress was up to. So because there wasn't going to be much news before the show, like overnight, and so that was easy. For TV, they tell me an hour before I go on, usually, what I'm talking about. Sometimes they don't tell me, they can't tell me. They don't know until like a minute before we go on what we're going to talk about. So, and that's kind of rough. That's scary. I like to have a little time to do some prep. I hate going on not knowing. And there have been times where they've thrown something to me about some bill that I hadn't even written about or covered, and you have to kind of bluff your way through. The cable TV, they have so much time to fill that so much is so slapdash that you can't even believe it. And they have experts, so-called experts on that are really not prepared at all, but it's so, that whole operation is so seat of pants. But it's terrific in a way, it's stimulating, but at the same time, I don't want to look like an idiot. So I usually get an hour to figure out what we're talking about and, what I want to say about it. And hopefully it's something I'm working on so I have a little bit of understanding. But sometimes it's not. I've gone on to talk about Blagojevich, which is something I haven't written about, and about the New York Senate race, which is also something I haven't really covered, but I do my best.
Yeah, if you have an hour. But sometimes what happens, I know in ones that I've done, is that you do your pre-interview with the producer, and they tell you what the topic is, and then you go over. Say for me, because I just go on very occasionally, they want to make sure that I know something. Mm-hmm. They know that you know something, so they don't have to do this kind of thing. But they'll go over what they want to talk about, and so we kind of settle everything, and then you go on, and it can be absolutely entirely different.
Yeah.
I did one with a station in San Francisco that was around the time of the inauguration, and we were going to be talking about the nomination process, confirmations by the Senate. So I had all my stuff together, and so they spent the entire time asking me about the move in and out of the White House, how physically the Bushes are going to leave and the Obamas come in, and the subject had absolutely never come up in our pre-interview.
Like, do they have movers? Do they have boxes?
Right,
was it that kind of thing?
Yes,
that's
right.
I mean, it's interesting, but
it is.
Yeah.
But if they could have told me beforehand, I would have appreciated it. Do you have that kind of experience?
Yeah, all the time. Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know what happens if they're new people in an hour or what. Well, for your general knowledge, what do you look at? What do you read? What are the various kinds of ways that you get information?
I'm on lots of lists. A lot of people now will do an email list, and they'll send out a bunch of links. These stories you must read today, and I'll read through those on my BlackBerry first thing in the morning. As soon as I get up, I'll just scroll and see, did something happen overnight? And then after I go through those headlines, then I'll take the time to go back and look online, look at stories, see what the top stories are, check the Washington Post, which I love that paper, and the New York Times, which feels like homework to me every time I read it. There's something about the New York Times that just wears me out.
There's so
much of it, and the stories, I don't like those, 70-word leads. I think the Washington Post, just from a writing perspective, is so much easier to read and consume than the New York Times. But, you got to check the Times, because it's the Times. And, and then I love the Wall Street Journal's Washington Wire blog. I think it's a digest of the news, and it's terrific. And those are my go-to things in the morning.
Uh-huh.
It's more about covering bases and being informed, so when my editor calls, I kind kind of know, you know, what the latest is and what I'm talking about and kind of what's coming up for the day.
Do you read Mike Allen's playbook?
Yeah, that's one of the ones that I get. But sometimes I read that one and he'll say, he'll list, he has a daily listing of what's driving the day, what's driving the conversation. And I don't know who he's conversing with, because sometimes it's something so off-topic that really isn't driving the day. But I think part of that is that I'm in such a White House vortex that what drives the day in the White House doesn't always drive the Washington day.
Uh-huh. What newspapers do you read in print form?
Just the Washington Post. Just the Washington Post. That's the one I get. And then, I try around the White House to pick up the Washington Times if it's there. And, you know, of course, I grab the Examiner because it's free and it's on the way. But they don't really do home delivery, so.
In your day, how much information do you depend on the White House for? And how do you get information from the White House?
The White House sometimes feels like the call you have to make. You know, there's so much news that, I mean, I do cover the White House, and I do follow what the president says, and that's always very interesting, and that always shapes the news of the day. But in terms of the briefing, I don't really use the briefing much except as a measuring stick to see what the White House position is on a particular issue or really what their message is, where they're taking, where they're heading, what sarcasm they're using to push back on stories, things like that. The briefing for me is not journalistically useful. What the president says today, he was talking about the torture memos, for example, in the Oval, and that was very interesting. That led to a story. So that's the kind of information I use from the White House. But in terms of relying on them for information, there's really no point to that. They put out what they want, and often it's, you know, it's sort of already been chewed up and spit out. It's not always very useful.
Would you say that was true in the Bush administration?
Yeah, sure, definitely. Uh-huh. Definitely. I mean, these communications operations are so slick and so sophisticated that they are almost, they spite the news. You know, you can't really get a straight answer or a meaningful answer. I don't know how the president reaches his decisions. I don't know what was considered and rejected. You just don't really get much other than what they dole out, which is usually not, it doesn't have a lot of depth or texture or deep meaning.
Do you think that their commitment to transparency during the campaign?
No, it's farcical. It doesn't apply to news.
I was going
to
say, do you think that is going to put them in a position where they're going to have to provide more? Here, what they did with the torture memos is they released the decision-making process.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they took it from the consideration of what kinds of alternatives they had through the adoption of a policy to its implementation.
Mm-hmm.
And if they can do that about previous administrations, I mean, you could make the case, why can't they do that with their own decision making? Do you think that there's going to be pressure for that? Or do you think,
I don't think there's
nobody
going to be pressure
expects
because
it?
No, well, I think they can say, when we talk about transparency, here we release these memos and we're being transparent. We are being open and transparent about how we feel about these torture memos, and we have released them, whereas the previous administration would not. But when it comes to their own, like the waivers people sign if they were lobbyists and they're now in the administration, you know, we've never seen those. There's been lots of requests for different documents or different pieces of information this White House won't produce because it doesn't suit them to do so. And I don't think there's ever going to be much public pressure for any White House, especially an incredibly popular president, to respond to the demands of journalists, because they will simply demonize reporters, which is what all administrations do. So there's never public support behind journalistic inquiry, except when it becomes something like the war in Iraq now. You know,
uh-huh.
Now there is, but a few years ago there absolutely was not. So it just depends. But I don't think they will be. I think the way they are now, opaque, uncooperative, not transparent, is the way they'll be. I think they've set the tone for the administration, and that's how they're going to be.
Do you find that there are some people that are more willing than others to provide information?
No, but I really haven't pushed for a lot of information. There's nothing that I have really demanded. I've seen other reporters go after things. I find some people more pleasant to deal with, but that's just a personal observation. I've not been told no or had anyone slam a phone down on me or anything like that. I mean, maybe in time.
or call you at 6:30. There was a reporter recently that who spoke at Towson, and a lot of the students went. Let's hope everybody went. They were assigned. Anyway, she talked about a story that she wrote that that resulted in a 6:30 a.m. phone call of a complaint that started at that hour. Mm-hmm. And I think that surprised me because I don't remember. I will say in the Bush administration they did it differently. Mm-hmm. They did calls, I think, probably within calling hours.
Yes, within normal business hours, definitely.
And emails, and lots of emails. I think one of the things that's happened with emails is it's provided an opportunity when they've gotten upset with a story to just immediately respond, hit send, mm-hmm. and they sometimes do so. But from a scholar's point of view, those emails that they send are presidential records.
Yes.
So at least we have, we can track that.
Well, what scares me is some of the emails I sent them might also be part of the permanent record.
That's true.
So tomorrow's scholars will be wondering what I meant by that and the use of inflammatory language. But what surprises me about that is that Obama is so popular still, especially with Democrats. He's got like 90% in the Democratic Party, something like 67% overall. And so disdainful of reporters. Why do they care so much what people write? Because obviously it doesn't affect his standing, his popularity.
Well, your standing in the Washington community can have a corrosive effect. So, for example, let's say that Jimmy Carter was popular with the American people, but within the Washington community, especially when he started on the water projects, there was a feeling that he really didn't know what he was doing, that he mm-hmm. couldn't pick what priorities he had and couldn't wrap them together in mm-hmm. any way, that he was taking a lot of different things that were just simply not linked. And that ultimately went down to the public.
That's interesting.
And he also failed to have a group of people within the Washington community who would say, oh, I know you're wrong about your judgment about the president, and the president really knows what he's doing because I've seen him in this situation. And so I think with Obama, they want to make sure that they have those kinds of people.
Which, again, is so interesting because they so disdain the Washington establishment and complain about it and mock it, and mm-hmm. yet they want to be of good standing within it.
Uh-huh.
So it's interesting.
Do you, when you're thinking about your role as a reporter, what do you think that your goal is? Is your goal representational in a way that you are representing the public, that you're a surrogate for the public, that the public can't come and ask questions?
Right.
So do you try, like if you're going to ask questions at a press conference, would you try to think of what people wanted to know about?
No, unfortunately. Well, I mean, yes, what people want to know about, but I consider mostly my role to be eyes and ears at the White House and informing the readers of what the president is doing and to the best of my ability why and how it affects them, to be more in an explanatory role. And then secondarily also a bit of a watchdog, and is he doing what he promised he would do, what he said he would do? Is he being consistent? But in terms of formulating questions for the president and for his spokesman, there's such a difficult process there because what people want to know sometimes won't make news. And when you do have a chance to question them, you want to make some news because that's also your function. But what people are interested in isn't always what's going to make news. I'm trying to think of an example. But I think sometimes people are interested in more in broader questions, and I think reporters are interested in much more, I don't want to say gotcha questions, but they want to get the president off his talking points, and they want to get the president to say something new and different and to advance uh-huh. a story, to move it along. whereas I think the public sometimes are a little more circumspect in what they would like to know. So it has a public service. There's a public element to it, but it's not a direct relation.
Uh-huh. What do you think the benefits are of questioning the president? I was just putting some things together of the three types of settings that that presidents respond to reporters: press conferences, short question and answer sessions, and interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And
the short question and answer, would you mean like that, like a pool spray?
Yeah, right. So in a session where, let's say, today with King Abdullah,
mm-hmm.
and that he's gonna take some questions as they're seated in the Oval Office, that only a pool can go in because not everybody in the press corps can. And so those sessions have been normally every couple of days. So in the first 100 days, let's say, of Clinton, I think, had, in his first 100 days, he had 82, I think, sessions.
Right.
Q&As. Mm-hmm. But he also had press conferences, and he mm-hmm. had some interviews. Bush had, I think he had around 59, a little mm-hmm. shy of 60. And Obama's had 16, and which I take to say, you know, he wants to control mm-hmm. what kinds of things he wants to do, what sort of settings he wants to put himself in. He wants to put himself in interviews and press conferences, particularly high-profile press conferences. What do you think they get? What does he get out of it? Of say the press conferences, things that are high-profile.
Well, both times he's used them to highlight something that was important to him. The first one was a stimulus package, and he wanted to talk about that, and he knew he was going to get questions about that. They game out what he's going to get asked. And so the stimulus, that was number one. And then the second one, I believe, was a budget, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was a budget, and he wanted to really highlight his budget and really put forward his own vision and do it through a press conference. And he knew that doing it at night in the East Room has a formality and a seriousness and a sort of a consequence. You know, it gives it real event status. Whereas Bush hated those press conferences. As you know, he hated those nighttime press conferences. He would never give us a long lead-in time because he felt that journalists, given like too long to think about it, would come up with these thespian-like questions. We'd get all rancid. The questions would be like 10 minutes long and build and build, and you know, and that we'd get all show-offy, which that was kind of true. And he liked to kind of spring it on you at the last minute. So there'd be times when I'd be in bed in the morning and I could hear my pager going off, and I'd look at it and it would be like press conference at the White House in 30 minutes. So
yeah.
I'd barely have time to get dressed and get down there, let alone formulate a question for the president. And that's what he banked on. And he loved that. He loved that element of surprise. And Obama has taken a completely different direction with press conferences and giving us like 4 days notice
uh-huh.
and things like that. And it really does give it such a sense of occasion.
Yeah. Well, he's in such a different position, number one, because of the crisis in the economy.
Mm-hmm.
But also, there's an enormous appetite for him.
Yes, people just want to know
yeah.
and see him. And
so you have the news organizations, television, willing to give up an hour of their programming. And that's a lot of money.
Right, and there were some that I had read that were very upset about it. They had to preempt American Idol and some other shows, and they were not pleased.
Yeah.
Some sports events, didn't like it. I'm not sure how much longer he can do that. I mean, certainly while he's still popular, but 2 years from now, I don't think we're going to be seeing those.
No, I think he understood that he can do it probably at the beginning.
Yeah, for sure.
So he's had those two, and then he also had a speech
mm-hmm.
in I think it was in February.
Right, the pseudo address
yeah.
to the nation.
Right, yeah, mm-hmm. right.
The state of the union.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which goals? He talked about the economy.
But one thing I want to mention about those pool sprays, like today in the Oval Office, when there's only a few journalists who have a chance to ask the president, they are very mindful of asking things that can be of general use. They're not going in there and asking a question that they need for their story. I mean, there's a real mindfulness, it's a very collegial mindset among the reporters who are in the pool to go in and ask the president questions that are timely, that are general, that other people can use, and also that will create news, but it's not just for them. You know, they're not going in and asking like a little internecine question that no one else can use the answer to. And I think that's an important facet of White House coverage, is that we do get so few bites at the apple that there's a real sense of collegiality about it. That the president is not anyone's possession, that we all have to work off the same limited amount of information from the White House.
Can you tell us how a pool works? Like, say the one today, how many people were able to go in?
I don't know. I didn't see how many people go in. Generally, there's one each from the wires, and they expand it at the White House to include AFP, which is the French wire service, and they get mm-hmm. in all the pools around the White House building. And then there's the AP, Bloomberg, Reuters contingent, right? And then there'd be like one newspaper reporter, and we rotate that. It's an alphabetical rotation. We come up once a month for that. Today was the New York Times. And then there'll be, a TV crew. And sometimes TV doesn't go. Sometimes they'll just send a producer in. Like towards the end of Bush, like a camera, didn't always go sometimes, There's other cameras there, and White House cameras and stuff like that. And then all the still photographers go in. And that's a big group. And that's a big jostling group of photographers right there. So, I want to say a little over a dozen go into the mm-hmm. Oval, and it's usually quick in and out, and they pull you right back out. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you ask a question, sometimes you don't.
In those instances when you're on the pool, who do you talk to about what questions you're gonna ask if you get the opportunity?
Sometimes it's. Do you mean who from the White House or
no? No.
From
other organizations. Like, if you think maybe you're going to get a question, mm-hmm. Who will you talk to?
The other reporters, and it's usually a consensus thing. We do talk and decide, and I've had other reporters in those situations come to me and say, "Look, it looks like you're going to get a question. I'm not telling you what to do, but could you ask him, if you don't have something better, could you ask him about the Middle East, or could you ask him what he's going to do about this or that?" I always do. That's what you do. And a lot of times there's a lot of obvious questions to be asked, and sometimes you just have to ask the obvious question, and so you just proceed. And you don't try to get fancy with it. It's like, this is the only shot we have all day of asking him a question. Let's ask him like a good one that everyone can use the answer to.
And that would most generally would be like the news of the day.
Mm-hmm. News of the day.
And is the president usually prepared for that?
Yes. Yeah. Well, this president especially is very comfortable talking off the cuff. He'll tell you what he thinks, whereas President Bush was often uncomfortable with that because he talked off talking points. And if he didn't have the talking points for a particular question, he would kind of hem and haw around it. And sometimes it would be a waste because you couldn't get a usable answer to your question if he wasn't prepared for it, if he wasn't expecting it and didn't have the cards ready to go in his mind. Whereas Obama seems much more comfortable if you ask him something he's not expecting even. He can handle it.
Uh-huh. Did you cover the campaign at all?
No, a little bit. I was busy getting laid off, so I was...
Before you were laid off, did you?
No. That was the whole thing. I was getting laid off during the campaign, so I didn't have a chance to cover Obama.
Yeah. Can you tell us about the trip that you took
yes.
with the president? Mm-hmm. How did your organization decide to send you? And give some idea. I don't want you to give out any secrets here of how much it costs.
Oh no, it's not a secret. How much? We haven't seen a final tally yet. I was told the Correspondents Association considers the bids for the airplanes for travel when we travel with the president, so they can usually give out a rough estimate of what the trip will cost generally.
Because that's the most expensive.
That's the most expensive, especially on this trip. President Obama went to London, Then we went to Strasbourg, France, then Prague, and then we went to Ankara and Istanbul in Turkey. So what gets expensive on these trips is the airplanes going from place to place. And because the president flies on Air Force One and he can take a small press contingent on Air Force One, there's room for about a dozen journalists. And he flies with the pool, but then everyone else, there's, you know, almost a couple hundred of us on a charter plane that the White House hires and that we all pay for. And that's the most expensive part of the trip. And they had estimated that was going to be about $20,000. And so that, and then you factor in, you know, lots of transportation, lots of buses, and then the filing centers that we work out of, and then hotel rooms, and, you know, and then miscellaneous and all the food and everything, it starts to pile up. So I haven't seen the final bill yet, but I think that's how much, about how much it'll be, hopefully not more. So the Examiner, the Washington Examiner, small paper, it's only been around a few years, but they really want to be serious about journalism. They really want to be credible. So my editor and I sat down at the end of last year, and he said, I want you to go on a foreign trip, probably the first one. He's probably going to go visit the Allies, the first big overseas trip. And we kind of guessed how much it was going to be, usually about this much. It costs more to go if you're going to go to Russia or something like that. It tends to be a more expensive trip, and the president will tack on more visits. But something like to Europe, that was going to be manageable. So we decided to go. The White House, about 2 weeks out, sends a sign-up. You have to give them all kinds of information. You have to get they get visas. They get everything for us. And they really plan the entire trip. And all you do is show up and go on it. We show up at Andrews Air Force Base to fly overseas. And we take turns on Air Force One, but a lot of people don't always want to fly on Air Force One because, first of all, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of extra work to fly on Air Force One because you're representing all the people who can't fly on Air Force One. So you have to be very vigilant. The White House briefs reporters on Air Force One, which I think you're probably familiar with, but not on the charter. So when you're on Air Force One, it's a lot more work. It's just a lot more work. And you're with the president, and so you're dead. You're running around a lot more, and it's a lot more work. You have to file more work. And when you're traveling overseas, you come to regard the charter as like the time when you get to sleep. So people did generally tend to want to fly on the charter. But so that's just the logistics. But it was a very, very eventful trip. Just in terms of usually these summits, these world leader summits that we go on, produce very little news, and they're very boring and hard to cover. This one was eventful. Obama had some things he wanted to accomplish, and some he accomplished and some he didn't. In both cases, news was made. He had wanted to get some commitments from other countries to send more combat troops to Afghanistan. He had really hoped that they would step up with that kind of support, and they didn't in the end. They didn't. They like what he's doing. They're 100% behind him, but they're not sending combat troops. The war in Afghanistan is really, really unpopular in Europe, and so those leaders were not willing. They're all made terribly vulnerable by this global economic crisis, so they weren't willing to expend any of their own treasury on what has now become Obama's war. So that was something really interesting to cover on this trip. It's not something you could have covered from back here. You definitely had to be on the trip. And then at the same time, there were fun things, like he met the Queen of England, you know, and that was great. And then Michelle touched the Queen, and that became a big thing that everyone was talking about. And it was interesting to see the President and First Lady overseas, because they were very different over there than they are here. When he's here, he's grumpy, he's impatient. And when he was over there, it was like he was campaigning again. He was so happy. He was loved. And he was not being questioned or challenged. Congress was a million miles away. We weren't even that close to him. He was so happy, and you could see it in his gestures were very broad, and people were crazy to meet him and screaming crowds. And Michelle Obama, who can be a little tough here, she's doesn't have a lot of real warmth. But when she went over there, she was extremely demure, and she was very ladylike and soft and almost kind of shy. And people were going crazy for them. And we were kind of laughing, saying, well, they're not like that at home.
How did you decide what stories you were going to do? What can you do beforehand?
Beforehand, you get a pretty good rough idea of the president's schedule, of what he's going to do on every single day, who he's having meetings with. Where you're going to be, you get a sort of a preliminary schedule, And so I sat down with my editors before I left, and we went through every single day and said, well, the story here is going to be this, and I'm probably going to write about that. And so we came up with a rough sched of stories that I was going to do when I was over there, with the understanding that once you get over there, sometimes these plans, you know, get blown up. There's news that you can't predict, and there's all kinds of things that you didn't foresee that become stories, or something you thought was a story isn't a story. So we had a rough outline, and for the most part, I pretty much stuck to it. I added stuff to it as I saw more things, but I would do two stories a day plus a reporter's notebook, which was kind of funny little items that weren't really stories, but that were noteworthy. So I had two stories plus the notebook, plus I was blogging my head off the entire time. I took my digital camera and I took a lot of pictures and posted the pictures on our blog, and that was really popular. They were really happy with that. It just gave it a different, you're kind of coming at the story from all different sides. So we got a lot of hits on our website for that, and that was great.
Uh-huh. How long have they had a website?
Since they started.
Uh-huh.
That's part of their thing, is to have a website, to have a real web presence. They just redesigned it.
Uh-huh. But you certainly had a lot of experience with it in
yeah.
the ones that you've done. It seems to me that in the time that I've been watching people at the White House, watching reporters work, that the job has become much more difficult because it is such a longer, it's a longer day instead of one story.
And there's much more in it. Yeah.
It's dealing with video mm-hmm. as well as the blogging, as well as the print. Do you find does that lead to, I'm not just saying with you, but but in the blogs that you read, do you think that leads to immature stories coming out?
Definitely I do, because there's so much pressure to, as soon as something happens, slap it on the web. Like, you don't have time to check to make sure if it's true or not, or to run down some more sources or get someone on the record. Is just slap it up there and try to get as many eyeballs on it, and then either, you know, flesh it out later or something. But I think it does lead to some pretty crappy journalism, and it's true, all these different things that we have to do. This is something that we talk about a lot at the White House among the press corps, is like, instead of just doing one thing well, a lot of us feel like we now do four different things not very great, you know, not that well. So we're so scattered, and the day is so short, and so in addition to trying to produce on all these different platforms, we're also trying to spend as much time in the presence of the president as possible. So, you know, if he has a speech off-site and we go to that, that's 3 hours gone out of your day, you know, when you could have been blogging or working on your story or going on TV. And,
right.
you know, so it's really hard to get eyeballs on the president as much as possible and do all the work you're expected to do. I'm not whining about it. I'm just saying that there's so many demands on your time that you end up doing everything sort of halfway rather than just one thing very well.
Uh-huh.
And that's too bad, because there's so many talented journalists at the White House.
Yeah, I noticed in President Obama's case, they bring the reporters in. Like, say he's going to have an event in the East Room, and he brings them. They get brought in early, even before the audience comes.
Oh my God!
And,
yeah,
and it's, so you're there, and then he has a tendency to be late.
He is so late. It drives me bananas. He's really late, and for example, his last press conference, we had to get there, I think, at 6:30, and the event didn't start till 8. He had to be on time then, because it was the networks, and he was not going to keep the networks
yeah.
waiting. But for a routine event at the White House in the East Room, yeah, he'll show up half an hour late, and he never apologizes for it. And I wonder, it could be two things. It could be his staff just not being able to keep him
right.
on schedule, or maybe he just doesn't care about other people's time. And he never apologizes, he never acknowledges his lateness, but he is so often late, and it just throws everything out of whack.
I think in the case of that press conference, when they told people the last entry was going to be 6:30 for the 8 o'clock press conference, what ended up happening is that people said that they were going to bring in, they're going to bring in water, and they were going to bring in snacks. And so there was an announcement that we weren't allowed to bring in either. No water, no snacks. And so then after that, then they said, there must have been complaints, that the last call was going to be at 7:20. And so they finally relented. Relented on that.
I watched that press conference from the newsroom because of our deadlines. That's another problem with these late-night news conferences is that if it starts at 8 and it wraps up at 9 and you get back to your desk at the White House by 9:15, then you might have 15 minutes to write a story, which is not really enough to do justice to a presidential press conference. Mm-hmm. So I and some other journalists had to watch it from our newsrooms, watch it on TV and file that way, which is a difficult way to do business because you want to be there. There's so much more you get from being present when he speaks rather than watching it on TV.
There are a lot of reporters that don't come to the White House, cover the White House, but are not there. Although that was much more a feature of the last year of the Bush administration than
journalists
now.
In absentia.
Yeah, out on the campaign trail. Mm-hmm. What do you get by coming to the White House? That people who try to do it from their desk in their office miss?
There's just a lot more to be picked up around the White House, even though we can't roam the West Wing, but just bumping into administration officials in the driveway, hearing what other journalists are saying and working on, going to the briefings, just being present, you get much more of a sense of the White House and its energy and its dynamics. When you try to do it off campus, it's really hard, and you never really feel like you're getting the full story. I mean, there's some days when I work out of my newsroom, and I don't go into the White House. Today was one of those days. And I felt very disconnected from what was happening there. I felt very out of touch with what was happening, and I didn't feel as confident of what I was writing as I would have if I had sat there all day and just been present at the White House. So that's a little thing. But I do think that that you can cover the White House without being there every day, but I think that there's something a little bit lacking if you don't go there fairly often, some understanding.
And part of it's too is relationships.
Relationships, yeah.
Yeah, that you don't meet the people in the lower press office, which would be where the deputies and the assistant press secretaries are, and who can be helpful to you.
Right, and when they see you around, they know that you've made a commitment to be there. There's been some problems with that, though, is that some of the people at the press conference who have gotten questions have been people who we had never seen before, had never been over there. And some of the wire services especially lodged a complaint and said, there has to be some payoff for coming here every day and committing ourselves to covering your administration. We have to have a chance to question the president. Uh-huh. That's just an understood thing. And the White House was very unimpressed by that argument. They said, you don't have to be over here. We're going to call on who we want.
It seemed to me that one of the things they missed in by not calling on Reuters is that was a news organization that would have asked foreign policy questions.
Foreign policy, right.
And that was a subject they really needed to deal with. And they didn't seem to have a way to deal with it. They could figure out the president had a border control, he had a border control event that day, so he could figure that the Univision person was going to ask, a Latina would ask about that, which she did, and then Stars and Stripes. So, you know, you can talk about the military, you know, you can be able to deal with any part of that, whatever he asks. But you miss something when you don't deal with Iraq and Afghanistan in a press conference, it would seem. Well, one of the features of life at the White House and for White House correspondents is the White House Correspondents Association, and I know you're
I'm running for the board.
You're running for the board. Tell us what the organization does. We haven't had anybody so far who has talked about it and its importance.
It is important. I call it the real power at the White House. The Correspondents Association, it's a board. They run interference between the press corps and the administration. They do the annual dinner, which some of you are probably familiar with. It's coming up. And they decide the seating chart in the briefing room, things like that. And they really, if you get into a tussle with the White House, which I have on occasion, They are your advocate. They will take up your case if it's legit and deal with the White House on your behalf. And they have a lot of power, and they have a lot of influence, and they really are. It's a professional association, but they do have a lot of clout at the White House. And it was impressed upon me this year that I have used their services in the past, and now it's time for me to give back. So I'm running for the board, and it's tough because it is truly a popularity contest. And if I don't win, I've seen people lose these elections and never be the same again. You know, they sort of like lose faith in covering the White House and leave the bead and just become unhappy. So I'm very nervous about it. Campaigning hard.
Yeah, get in there early.
Yeah, I've tried to scare off all the competition, but you know, there's always some last minute person going to jump in the race.
Well, let's take some questions. It's your guy's turn.
At one point you said that what would drive the Washington, D.C. news would not necessarily be driving the White House. Can you explain that a little more and give an example or two?
Let me think of an example. You know, there are certain instances where Congress becomes the story, something's going on up there. And it may have its roots in the White House, but it may not be the big storyline of the day, may not be coming out of the White House. There's times when the president travels and he's out of town and what he's doing isn't really news here in Washington. I think tomorrow he's going to Iowa for Earth Day. Is that tomorrow?
Mm-hmm.
Earth Day?
Yeah.
And I don't think that's going to drive the discussion here in Washington. So that's an example. That's what I was talking about. A lot of times, especially when the administration is new, what the president is doing does drive Washington, especially because the Republican Party right now doesn't have like any really strong leadership. It doesn't have a real strong voice to counter the high-profile Obama administration. So it ends up that the White House does drive the agenda, but there are cases when that doesn't happen.
Yeah, it might be that sometimes the economy is the issue for the public around the country, but on a particular day it may be like, say, Senator Leahy is holding hearings a while back about a truth commission. And
So the White House is more reactive than setting the agenda.
So they're what's happening around the country is not necessarily the big news in Washington, because In part, people may not have a fix on just what the public is thinking in particular areas. Another question? We have nobody. The class is not here in the room, so you all have all the questions. So everybody has to ask a question.
Yes, ma'am. Do you feel obligated to write a column that's more of an eye catcher for your readers, since a lot of newspapers are falling on the wayside?
That's an interesting question. No. It would be great if I did, or if I could find something like that every day. You can't always hit a home run every day. No, I don't, and I don't try to look for the angles that are going to make people mad or drive hits to our website. Sometimes a lot of what the president does and says is very dry, and it doesn't always, you know, sort of get people hopped up. So, no, it's great when that happens, but it's not something I strive for.
Another one? Well, before the next person asks one, when you were talking about getting news from the White House and how difficult it is to get news, William Price was thought to be among the first correspondents at the White House, and he came in 1896, but in the early 1900s he wrote about the White House as a bee, and he said, his words were, "You are rarely given news at the White House." He said, "You have to be like a miner and dig for it."
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, and you take on the miner and put on your miner's hat, where do you go? Where do you get information?
Well, I think of the White House more as the center of something, and I sort of spiral around it. You know, something's coming out of the White House. Say, for example, Obama says something about the Middle East, and instead of digging at the White House, because all you're going to get is a repetition of what Obama said on the Middle East, I'll like go talk to some think tanks about, you know, or I'll some experts and some sometimes you or if it's not the Middle East so much, but some other issue, you can go to the agencies the departments that are not often as buttoned down as the White House, and you can get some further information there. So the White House is sort of like the, you know, it's like the crispy center. But there's so much else around it that helps add to a better understanding of where the White House is coming from on a particular issue, or where the White House is heading. Congress is also a great source of news about the White House, because there's a lot of conversation that goes back and forth. So if you have a few good relationships in Congress, you can hear from them what the White House is telling them and kind of get a little different take on an issue from what the White House is saying. So all of Washington really is part of covering the White House.
Uh-huh. I've noticed in your stories, you have a lot of people that you've known from Texas who are good
great sources. I know.
Yeah.
When I was at the Houston Chronicle, there was such a premium on only use Texas sources in a story. If, you know, even covering the White House, you got to call Texas experts and people at Texas universities and members of Congress from Texas. And so over the years, those became a really good source pool for me. So now I'm at the Washington Examiner, and I'm kind of still calling people from Texas, because those are my relationships, and those are the great relationships that I've built. At the same time, the Examiner doesn't really have the clout, it doesn't have the presence, doesn't have the reputation to get the great callbacks from the good sort of pundit class around town. So I can't really rely on callbacks from people like think tanks here and stuff like that, who would much rather be talking to the Washington Post or the New York Times. So I do kind of keep going back to the Texas pool. That's interesting that you mentioned that. My editors have not mentioned that yet.
Well, they've been particularly good quotes. I mean, people who
well, they're people I
very
know
good.
And trust, yeah. And have worked with for years, and it makes a huge difference when you're talking to them. They trust you, and you know what they're good at, what they're good at talking about.
Uh-huh.
They're all Texans.
Yeah, relationships really, really are important. That you mentioned trust. In what ways do you have to develop trust? How do they build trust in you? That they're gonna trust that that you're going to treat them fairly.
By treating them fairly over time, by not trying to trip them up, by dealing with them squarely. When I talk to someone on the phone, I tell them exactly what my story's about, exactly what I'm working on. I don't try to be cagey about it, and I'm myself with them, and I lay out, here's what I'm working on, here's my question to you. And then you quote them accurately, and then if the story changes, you maybe let them know about it or send them a note saying, hey, it's shifted direction a little, but I'm still going to use this quote, you know, that kind of thing. And you just keep an open dialogue. Interaction with sources is not a gotcha thing. In order to build trust, you have to make them part of the process, because it's scary. Even if you're a pundit, to put your reputation in the hands of a journalist you don't know. You never know how that's going to turn out, and so you have to develop these relationships over time.
Yeah. No, that's very true. Somebody else? I think, Roger, there might be a question there. No? Oh, you wrote it. Okay. Okay, Towson?
At one point, you had gone on this, that you were very set on this fact that the newspaper acts as a watchdog, and you see them as almost a check on the government, because you seem to really make it seem very important that a lot of people were leaving, and then that check was almost disappearing in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I just kind of said the question without saying a question, but do you feel like they act as a check on the government, and that's their main job?
Well, yeah. Every reporter approaches it differently. Some reporters I know do consider watchdogging to be their primary function, and certainly investigative journalists feel that way. I think government reporters feel a stronger allegiance toward informing readers about what the government is doing, and then secondarily having a watchdog function. That's how I feel. I feel it's more important to tell you what they're up to, let you decide, and then if they're up to no good, let you know about that, or if there's inconsistencies, let you know about that. But first is always to explain and inform what the president's doing, and I think that's very important work. You know, it's very chic here in Washington, and certainly among bloggers, to denigrate the work that White House reporters do, to make light of it. But I think what the president says and does is so important. And conveying that, being a means of conveying that, is a big responsibility. So I put that first, and then watchdogging is always, you know, right in there after that.
Yeah, and investigative reporting is it's difficult to do that from the White House.
Oh, yeah,
it's just
impossible.
Generally not part of the White House beat. And I know the White House press corps took a lot of hits for not having come up with the story on weapons of mass destruction. But the reality is that the mission that White House reporters have is very different. And they're not in a place where they can dig up that kind of information.
Right, that's just not the job at all.
Right, and so you have, you know, you have investigative reporters like, say, Walter Pincus,
mm-hmm.
And Dana Priest, mm-hmm. who have long-standing relationships within the intelligence community, which is what it takes, because that relationship of trust.
Right,
is
and they don't have the demands
important.
Of like having to
right.
know, write daily stories all the time, which most White House reporters do.
Yeah, you were talking about bloggers and their criticism. There was a piece this weekend in the Washington Post about the irrelevance of the White House press corps,
written by a blogger.
Yeah.
Right. It was Anna Marie Cox had a piece in the Washington Post, a short little piece about, like, let's get rid of the White House press corps. All they do is passively receive news. And her proposal was, hey, when the president talks about the economy, send your Treasury reporter or a business writer. When the president talks about foreign policy, send your State Department reporter. Well, my paper doesn't have someone at the State Department. We don't have anyone at Treasury. Lots of papers don't anymore. It's just not even feasible. You have to have White House reporters. It's absolutely essential to democracy to have people who are willing to check and challenge and watch the president. It's essential. And the thought that we should be cavalier about it or just blow it off because, you know, it's hard and they don't tell us much is very undemocratic to me. I didn't like that. But like I said, it's very insouciant among bloggers to be flippant about White House coverage. It's a hard job. It's damn hard. It's a hard job to get. And then once you get it, it's a hard job to do with any credibility. So, you know.
Yeah.
That's all.
Okay.
Not that I feel strongly. Not that I've given it thought or feel strongly.
Yeah, I know. It's just... people tend to not understand what it is that covering a White House involves.
Or who a White House reporter
is.
People often ask me about Tim Russert. Did I see him much? No, he didn't cover the White House at all.
Yeah.
You know, nor has Sam Donaldson for many years.
Yeah. Another question?
Here we go. Yeah. You just mentioned how difficult it is for what you do. I mean, how difficult is it for a paper like the Washington Examiner, which I'm assuming it is smaller, to compete with papers in D.C. like the Washington Post and like the Washington Times?
Well, the Washington Times is a little different. I'll take the Washington Post as an example. If someone has, it's impossible to compete against them. I mean, they have like five people covering the White House. And plus, if someone, say someone in the administration had a big scoop they wanted to drop somewhere, they're not going to give it to the Washington Examiner. For maximum impact, all big scoops must go to the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Washington Post. So you just have to take the whole idea of getting big exclusives or these special interviews or a major sit-down with the president before a big speech. You just have to take that off the table when you're anyone other than those three papers. So it is tough to compete, but Well, when I said it was hard, what makes it hard is that there's such a range of issues that we cover. You know, one day it's Social Security, the next day it's foreign policy, the next day something else, and you have to get up to speed really fast, and it's never the same day twice. And it's always very challenging, and it's very high pressure, and it's a lot to understand and process. So, and also you're not getting a lot of help from them. You're not getting a lot of your questions answered. You're not getting a lot of assistance. And so it's very challenging in that way. But in terms of competing, at the White House, there's so few opportunities to get an exclusive or to get a big story. Where the competition comes in is writing it very well or having a different take on it or doing a very nice job on a story. And so that's where we compete with each other, on having a good bead on things or seeing something before someone else does, seeing something come down the road or something more like that, rather than trying to worry about, like, the New York Times has some big exclusive, why didn't the Examiner have it? It's just not a consideration.
How do you know whether they've read your stories?
Well, sometimes they'll make little remarks about it. Nothing major. Obviously, the Examiner isn't a hugely important paper to the Obama administration. The opinion writers at my paper are very, very critical of this administration, and one of the things that my editors want me to do is write very straight, very fair, not have any sort of slant at all. They want our reporting to be very credible. So the Obama administration hasn't always liked what I've written, and they haven't always treated me great, but I haven't gotten any screams, and I think that if I'd written the same stories in a bigger paper, I would have. But they don't. They're not to the point now where they take the Examiner seriously as a major threat to Obama's stature as a president.
Uh-huh.
I don't think many papers have that cachet.
Uh-huh. Okay. Question?
You're at a smaller newspaper now. Do you find yourself able to act differently because of that? Say, before you had just spoken a few seconds ago about being critical of the administration, I was going to ask whether you you acted differently and tried to please them more so you could get that scoop. But I guess
I'm never going to get that scoop. trying to please them is
what? Can you act differently? Oh, sorry.
Do I act differently?
Yeah.
Well,
act differently even? Yeah. Sorry.
It is different because when I was at the Houston Chronicle, it was very hard to criticize President Bush because our readers of the Houston Chronicle loved President Bush and they thought he was a terrific president. So there was a lot of pushback from management about writing very critical stories about the president, even as his numbers tanked, even as the war went bad for him. It was hard to get those kinds of stories in the paper. At the Examiner, it's very different, and they are very, they don't want to slant on stories. They want stories to be straight. But if a story is critical of the president legitimately and can be supported, then that's very welcome. So it's different. It's a very different experience covering the president for the Examiner, and I feel it has a lot more integrity than it did at the Chronicle, where there was a lot more concern about how readers were going to react to stories. They didn't want boycotts. They didn't want advertisers losing their mind. They just wanted, you know, they didn't want to upset the readers because it became a very bottom line concern for the paper. At the Examiner, there isn't that concern at all, and so it sort of frees up my journalism. I feel less constrained, which is interesting. And it's a tabloid, so my stories are much shorter, which I also find an interesting challenge.
Do you find that that they become less colorful in a way because you have to you're dealing with a lot of
just the opposite because it's a tabloid and my editors keep telling me to try to have a little more fun with it, you know, try to use zippier language and try to use more colorful language, whereas when I was writing for the Chronicle, I was so concerned I had more length in a story, so I was concerned about getting more sources, packing more information in. Now I have a much smaller box and I can fill it with more brightly colored objects. So it's much more fun. I find it much more fun to write for tabloid style papers.
What's the difference of what you write for print, for the web,
mm-hmm.
and what kinds of subjects you would use for video?
Oh gosh, for video and blogging, behind the scenes stuff is a really big hit. And that's the thing for White House correspondents. We do get to go to the White House every day, and we get to see stuff that other people don't see. And there's a lot of things that are interesting. It's sort of like a backstage pass to the White House, and so that's what I try to do with my blogging quite a bit. And I've tried to do that a little bit with video. I'm getting a little better at it. But I went on this trip with Obama, and, you know, I was just kind of filming some of the preparations for the trip and kind of what being on the plane was like with all these journalists and you know, landing in Strasbourg at, you know, 5 in the morning and stuff like that. It's kind of the behind-the-scenes stuff, which I think makes really good internet fodder, which is stuff that would never find its way into the paper, you know, that kind of information. And so the paper is much more straight news. And the internet is much more for kind of little offbeat things.
What about your writing for the blog?
The writing style? Oh, the blog is much more lively and sarcastic, and it's always much more fun. You can have fun and have attitude without being opinionated, and that's a very tough thing to learn and develop. I see younger writers try to do it, but it's something that really comes with experience. Something comes with long practice to write that way. And it's a real discipline. And so that's what a lot of good newspaper blogging is now, is a little attitude, mm-hmm. but without opinion.
Mm-hmm. Question?
Yes, so... with TV media like Jon Stewart and Hannity... as a main source for the youth and young adults to look at for information like worldly events, international events, do you feel that the paper is now outdated compared to what it was in the past, or do you feel like you have to be in competition with those figures as well?
Well, that's an interesting question. Jon Stewart is a satirist. You know, he's not a newsman. He does use news as a foundation for his satire. So I'm very worried about people getting their news from Jon Stewart because it's very, very skewed. Sean Hannity, same thing. Neither of these men are under any obligation to give you the full story, and nor do they. So I don't consider it competition. I consider it a supplement. But what worries me is that people are using it as a substitute for following news. In the news business, we always tell ourselves that, yeah, young people, you know, younger people, even college-age people, don't care about the news until they start paying taxes, until it starts affecting them. And then they do start reading the paper. They do start following news. But I'm not sure that's the case anymore. And so I worry about that as a trend.
We have a question here in the room.
Oh, all right.
What are the risks and what are the rewards for asking the president a really tough question and putting him on the spot? And how does his level of popularity among the press corps affect that balance?
Huh, interesting. I'm not sure there are any real risks to asking the president a very tough question. The rewards are that you can knock him off some talking points, get a real answer, get something really substantive from him. That would be extremely rewarding for democracy, for everyone. Maybe not so much for him. His staff might give you the cold shoulder. That might be the consequence. His popularity doesn't really figure into it so much. There's a general belief that the White House press corps or that reporters in general are in the tank for Obama. But I can tell you that's not the case at all. And if you read the transcripts, if you look at the coverage, the White House feels it's very critical, it's very tough, and I don't really know anyone who is emotionally involved with the success of this president. So I don't think his popularity affects how questions are asked. In fact, when you look at the last press conference, there were some really tough questions. There was a press conference when we were abroad, and the questions to the president, one after the other, were so tough that some critic referred to it as a murderer's row of questioners. And I certainly know that the White House thinks that the White House press corps is exceedingly critical mm-hmm. and tough on him. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I was just trying to think of press conferences where where questions have been particularly tough.
Well, do you remember when he snapped it at Ed Henry?
Right,
That was funny. No, but when we were overseas and there were questions to him about, you didn't get what you wanted on Afghanistan, and you didn't get this, and you didn't get that. And
no stimulus packages.
From there. And he finds it frustrating. He is very professorial, and he doesn't like to be challenged or called out. He thinks that reporters are... He seems to think that reporters are not substantive and lack stature and standing. He doesn't like to be criticized, and it comes out, I think, in his answers.
And that has been a hallmark of every president. Woodrow Wilson is the first president to hold open access press conferences that had a large number of people, and he was very critical. And at some points, and I noticed Bush did it a couple of times, he said, if I were a reporter, I would ask me such and such, because he didn't like the questions.
Right.
And Bush did that, and Bush did it too. Somebody was asking me whether that was the first time a president had done that. And I said, nope, you can just go right back to Wilson Ford. They didn't like the questions. And so finally he called an end to them. Carter did as well, because he was very critical. He said that he just thought that the White House press corps just focused on trivia. In reality, Carter benefited by the press conferences because they showed him to be someone who really knew policy well. Mm-hmm. That he may have been stuck in the weeds. That he knew he could cite you a section, you know, particular sections of a tax act, or tax code, but they had helped him. Yet he was frustrated by them. Do you have another? Okay. Well, you can work on it. Roger's gonna have to come up with one. Okay, Towson.
With the growing dwindling number of newspapers and the actual economy and stuff, and the fact that a lot of newspapers are actually closing down, do you feel like the government may step in and try and bail out newspapers? And do you feel like that's appropriate for the government to be bailing out a supposed check on the government?
Yeah, no, I think that's terrible. John Kerry is having hearings on that, and I just think it's I don't know anyone who thinks that's a good idea. That's just a terrible idea. Last thing you want is the government meddling in newspapers. Although they are dependent on newspapers, there's a mutual dependency, but I think that would just be awful. I mean, a lot of newspapers have bad business models, you know, and people don't want what we're giving them, and something's got to give, but I don't think government bailout is the answer.
In an earlier time period when newspapers were having difficulties, Congress passed legislation that allowed them to print together, that it wouldn't be a violation of antitrust. Mm-hmm. So you can really go back to the beginning of our country and find that with postal considerations, you know, newspapers are allowed to be sent through they were allowed to be sent through the mails at a cheaper rate.
Well, in the First Amendment too.
but there are a lot of things that government has done over the years.
Aspect,
mm-hmm. that they have seen the stake that we have that's expressed in the First Amendment. So it's what do you see as an answer? Say in 10 years, what do you think will happen to news organizations, newspapers in particular?
It's hard to say. I mean, I see a grim future, the rise of niche publishing. Some of my most talented friends in journalism have gone into what we call niche publishing, newsletters that focus on specific issues that are for subscribers and that kind of journalism, which is still thriving, but general newspapers have died out. I see a lot of niche publications arising, even like Politico, you know, like that model. So they just cover politics, but they don't really worry about the policy so much. and they seem to be doing well. So, you know, and then newspapers, regional newspapers, just seem to get worse and worse. In big cities like Milwaukee and Detroit and places like that, it just seems to be no money. So you think they get worse, and then you got to rely on the big three, you know, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, and New York Times to, you know, keep it real. But it's just hard to see where this goes, and it doesn't seem to be going anywhere good.
Yeah, and you look even at the Washington Post, now that we're getting is just a shadow of what it was even a year ago.
Right, and what perplexes me is how people are gleeful about this, and like, yay, we killed another paper, and these journalists are so arrogant, and man, I hear it, and I kind of get where they're coming from, but I think it's so wrong-headed, especially when it comes from bloggers who are so dependent on news content
for
to make their blogs go. So,
yeah. So, do you think that that some kind of tax or fee is going to be the way to do it?
You mean like
on the internet?
On the internet.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, once you start giving it away for free, it's hard to go back and retroactively charge. I think people now are used to the idea that news is free and they don't want to pay for it. And the Examiner is trying its own model. Our paper is free, our web content is free, and it's paid for by advertising. And it's all paid for by advertising and by our owner. And that's a model that may come into existence. You see some papers are going to home delivery just a few days a week and becoming more of a web enterprise. That seems to be a trend. But I don't really see why people would pay for the Dallas Morning News online. I don't see that. I think that would probably lead to more citizen journalism, which is a trend that I think is not great for journalism. You know, you need professionals doing journalism. This is a profession. It's not a hobby. It's not a partisan pursuit. It's a profession. And citizen journalism is no substitute for real journalism.
What are the steps that, say, when you and your editor have worked on what you're going to write about,
mm-hmm.
and then you do when you send it in. What kind of professionals are there back at the newspaper? Like, talk about, you know, the copy editing,
all
of those people that we don't see, but who are very important.
Very important, and they really protect the integrity of the product. And it makes it so noteworthy when you see a mistake in a story, because you know how many people that story went through. There's my editor, an editor behind him, then the copy desk, and, you know, someone writes a headline, and there's a lot of people who keep their hands on a story before it gets published.
Mm-hmm. But for example, this past weekend, the Washington Post had its op-ed page was published twice. It was published Saturday and Sunday in a lot of papers. In the early editions, and that's just not something you expect to see.
Right.
But one of the things that's happened is that you just don't have the same kind of copy editing that you once had. Not so long ago, there was an article, an op-ed piece about Scott McClellan, who we both knew, that was on the op-ed page of the Washington Post, and his name was misspelled. The entire piece, his name was misspelled, never spelled correctly.
Right. And these are some of the casualties of the cuts in newspapers. Yeah, it's terrible. But, you know, it surprises me that there aren't more mistakes, that there aren't more mistakes in newspapers. You think there's, like, you know, a couple hundred stories a day in most major newspapers, and most of them are done without error, and they're clean, and the headlines are right. And that's, you know, that's the daily miracle. So when we lose people, we're definitely losing quality, in addition to the quality of reporting.
Yeah. Roger, do you have one? No. Okay. Well.
Oh.
Oh. Yeah.
Nope.
Good.
Earlier, you commented on the level of transparency in communications from this new administration. I'm concerned about some of the things I understood you said. Is the press reporting in such a way that this lack of transparency is exposed, and greater transparency will be rewarded? And are there other moves that can be made to bring about greater transparency in White House communications?
It has gotten some attention. The first thing that happened when this administration came into office was their very first briefing, before Robert Gibbs ever got to the podium, they had an off-the-record, off-camera, not-for-attribution briefing by senior White House officials about Gitmo. And we sat in the briefing and were only allowed to refer to these officials as senior administration officials. We couldn't identify them in stories, which a lot of us, I don't quote people I can't name. I don't use that. I mean, I might listen to it and hear the information, but I can't quote something like that. And this was a major shift in U.S. policy, and the administration wanted to do it off camera and away from, you know, being named and accountable. And that was really tough, and that got everyone's alarm went off at that. And then on this trip that I just went on with the president overseas, again, we got a lot of briefings from people who wanted to be referred to as senior administration officials. In some cases, they weren't. They were mid-level administration officials at best, talking about what the president was doing and what the president was saying. And again, it was information of limited value. The president was doing very real, very important work, and they wouldn't tell us about it, and they wouldn't go on the record about it. And these were things that are important to America that they were just not sharing. And certainly that got a lot of attention. I don't think the media complaining about it will change those policies. I think what will happen is that Obama's approval numbers will come down, and they will be forced to be more transparent, more forthcoming, more on the record. I think now everyone loves him. They can get away with whatever they want. No one's going to call him on it except a bunch of reporters, and who cares what whiny White House reporters think. But as we saw with Bush, they became a little more cooperative when people didn't like him as much.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Julie.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for the great questions, guys. I appreciate it.